This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. A group of activists and historians has been working to recognise the victims of the Ocoee massacre on Election Day in 1920. The work of the Truth and Justice Project of Orange County is also part of a nationwide movement to create memorials to lynching victims and help the communities where those lynchings took place come to terms with the past. Last week, the Truth and Justice Project hosted a screening of The Yard, a documentary about a professor's discovery of a slave yard in a parking lot in the church he attends in downtown Memphis. John Ashworth and Margaret Vandiver with the Memphis Lynching Sites Project spoke at the film screening. They joined me for a conversation along with Orlando historian Joy Wallace Dickinson. Well, John Ashworth is the executive director of the Lynching Sites Project of Memphis. John, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting us.
We're also joined by Dr. Margaret Vandiver. She's a retired professor with the University of Memphis, and she is a researcher for the Lynching Sites Project. Dr. Vandiver, thank you as well.
Thank you.
And Joy Wallace Dickinson is an historian and task force member of the Truth and Justice Project in Orange County. Joy, thank you as well.
Thank you.
John, I want to start with you. Tell me about the movie The Yard. What is this all about?
The movie The Yard is all about, everyone has heard of Nathan Bedford Forrest, who was a general in the Confederate Army during the Civil War, founder of the Ku Klux Klan. Anyway, in 1954, after the Brown versus Board of Education was passed, in 1955, people in Memphis erected a marker on the site where he had his slave yard. And the site says that Nathan lived here and he was a successful businessman. Dr. Tim Huebner found that goes to Calvary Church, and the Calvary Church parking lot is exactly where that slave yard was. And once Dr. Huebner found that out, he had his historical methods class do the research to find out how he made his money. And that tells the story. And this is the documentary called The Yard, because it is The Yard is where he had his actual slave yard. That's why it's called The Yard. And so they have done the research to document the names of the people who were, in fact, slaved and sold from there and erected a new marker. So that's what this documentary, The Yard, is really all about.
So the original marker was commemorating Nathan Bedford Forrest as a successful businessman?
Yes.
And is that marker still there?
That marker is still there.
But there's now a companion marker
telling the true story, mm-hmm. the complete history of who Nathan Bedford Forrest really was. When you say successful businessman, what was his business? His business was selling people.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about the process of getting people to see the full picture there and marking that. Was that difficult? Was it difficult to get the community to accept that this is not the full story?
I'll kind of defer to Dr. Vandiver here. I don't think it was that difficult. That church has said, because they're in downtown Memphis, mm-hmm. and that church has said, we want to be involved. We want to take a look at the city, what we can do to help the city. So they start to do research. And in doing the research is when they found out where our parking lot is where the slave trade took place. And we need to do something about that. I mean, if you're going to be a church, churches need to do that. And so I think that was the impetus for it. I'm not aware of pushback in downtown Memphis or in Memphis proper against doing that. As a matter of fact, Dr. Huebner did not think he would have as many people supportive. But the day, and we had the dedication doing MLK 50 in Memphis downtown. Mm-hmm. The church was literally packed and overflowing. And spontaneously, people read the names of the people that were enslaved. For example, someone would say Mary, age 10, Sally, age 4, John, age 20. And people would just start standing up. And by the time they finished, everybody in the church is literally standing up. Tears are flowing. The community embraced it. Memphis is, to their credit, is really trying to deal with our past. Mm-hmm. And that is a lot of what we're really all about.
Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Vandiver, let me bring you into the conversation. Telling the real history of this particular place in Memphis sort of speaks to what the Lynching Sites Project is all about, right?
Yes, it does. What we're trying to do is tell the full history of race relations in Shelby County, and there is a tremendous amount of violence that occurred that has either been forgotten or has been misrepresented. One of the worst race massacres in American history happened in Memphis in 1866. I believe there were 46 African Americans killed, known, and probably others unknown, and two whites. And for many years, that's been called the Memphis Riot. It was not a riot. It was an all-out assault on the African-American community by whites. And what we're trying to do with the Lynching Sites Project is identify every case in which people were lynched by mobs and find as much of that history as we can and then commemorate it.
How much of that history is written down?
Not a lot of it, and much of what is written is scattered, contradictory, difficult to find. You have to really dig in the historical records, and you have to read the newspapers very critically. We do not have an existing African-American newspaper from the lynching era in Memphis, so we're relying entirely on the white press, and that brings with it a lot of difficulties, obviously.
Now, when you say the lynching era in Memphis, when was that? Because there's a pretty big span when you talk about that period of American history across the entire South, right?
Yes. The earliest lynching we've identified was 1851, and the most recent was 1939. The height of lynching in Shelby County was in the 1890s. Which seems to be true in many areas of the American South.
Mm-hmm. Well, Joy Wallace Dickinson, hearing this and thinking about what was happening in Shelby County, there are echoes of what was going on in Orange County, right? I mean, and you're involved in a project to try and get people to understand the history of what happened in Ocoee. Just catch us up to speed. What was going on there, and why is that important, and how that fits into this conversation?
Well, it's so interesting listening to John and Margaret, because so many of the themes that have come up there come up, I think, everywhere where you're dealing with this kind of difficult history about lynching. And the event in Ocoee was a long time called the Ocoee Riot. This happened, but is now usually called the Ocoee Massacre. One of the most influential and dramatic events that happened in Orange County, but for a long time just was a taboo to even talk about, I think, in both the black and white communities. It happened on election night 1920. It was the first election in which women were allowed to vote. Unlike a lot of cases, it did revolve around voting. And at the end of election day, basically, the black community of Ocoee had been destroyed, and a melee had erupted, and many people died, and including one well-known victim, July Perry, who was lynched in Orlando.
And there is work underway now to get folks to recognize that this happened and have some kind of marker saying this is what happened on this place at this time.
Right. I'm a volunteer with the nonprofit Truth and Justice Project of Orange County, which is affiliated with the Equal Justice Institute in Montgomery. And part of our goal is to document cases of lynching and to bring this history to the public and acknowledge it, study it and acknowledge it, and commemorate it with markers. And we've, in fact, already planned in had a marker approved to honor Mr. Perry that's going to be dedicated in June. We've also held a lot of events around Orange County to educate people about the history of the event and discuss it, and with the goal of reconciliation and the feeling that you can't really heal wounds from these events unless you really talk about them and learn about them. And that is difficult to do because, as Margaret said, it involves piecing together records and documents from newspapers and people's letters and census records. It's not so easy.
John, how long has the Lynching Sites Project been underway?
The Lynching Sites Project is probably coming up on about 3 years in existence. In December of 2015, Brian Stevenson, the founder of the Equal Justice Initiative, spoke to a group of people in Memphis. And what he said is that Shelby County, Tennessee, you had more lynchings than any other county in the state. And at that time, they had identified 21. When Dr. Vandiver joined the staff, we now know about 37 individual cases that occurred. But that's how the Lynching Sites Project got started, with the idea that we are going to confront what happened in Shelby County in some meaningful way. And we began to do that. We've erected two markers thus far. We have two more in the process going this year, and we have some others in the pipeline as well. So we're about 3 years old.
And it sounds like, I mean, describing the response to the marker you're talking about, which is discussed in the movie The Yard, there was pretty good support for that. But what about some of these other sites? Has there been some pushback?
Let me tell you about Shelby County. Shelby County actually has seven other governments inside of Shelby County. And some of those things exist because of this resistance between white, black. I mean, it's for want of a better word, it's white flight, or it's protecting that. Some of the communities have given us a little bit of pushback and said, no, we really don't want to do that. Other communities have totally embraced it. One, we just did one last year, L. Persons. Last year was the 100th anniversary in 1917. In 1917, a man by the name of L. Persons was lynched on the Wolf River in Memphis, and there were 5,000 people there. It was called a spectacle lynching. Well, Lynching Sites Project decided to do a 100th commemoration or memorialization and put a marker up. Two high schools in Memphis, high school students found out about it and got involved, and they did their own research about it, and they came up with a separate marker. So we erected two markers about L. Persons. We had the event, and we had probably 500 or 600 people there who actually embraced this. So, but overall, I would say that Memphis, Tennessee, for the most part, and most of Shelby County, has in fact embraced this, that we do need to do that. Yes, there's some pushback. Mm-hmm. Margaret, you...
Yeah, I agree with that. I think Memphis as a city is about 65% African American, and the county is much whiter. So sometimes I think approaching this out in the county is going to be a little bit more difficult, perhaps, to get the support. But if I could just say one other thing about the L. Persons commemoration. Mr. Persons was lynched because he was a suspect in the beheading and murder of a young white girl. We were able to trace collateral descendants of Mr. Persons and of the victim in the case, and they came to the commemoration, and the two of them, the descendant of the murder victim and the descendant of the lynched man, stood together and unveiled the marker together. So that was an extraordinary moment for us to be able to bring those two families together and bridge that history.
Is that unusual to have that kind of reconciliation underway? Because, I mean, this is painful stuff.
It's very painful, and sometimes the descendants of people who were involved in lynchings do not want to confront that. And you can certainly understand that they don't want to think of their relatives, their ancestors, in that light. So it's very difficult.
You mentioned, though, the crowd that assembled to watch this. And
the original legend, yes.
Right. And a lot of them there were postcards made of them. I mean, the photographic record it's horrifying and extraordinary at the same time.
It is. And you have to keep in mind, doing this era, you're in an era when this is occurring literally all over the country. It's concentrated in the South, and Dr. Vanna has written a book about this called Lethal Punishment. But you have to keep in mind that it was actually published in the paper that there is going to be a lynching. This happened in any number of lynchings all over the Southeast, that there's going to be a lynching. And people would let church out even. And they'd even run buses, and they'd even run trains out to where these lynchings are going to take place. And that's what happened in this case. In this case, it was announced that there was going to be this lynching. They took him back out to the site where they found the young lady. They tied him to a log. They set him on fire. And there's a report that they had a young African-American young man about 9 years old sitting there that made him sit and say, go back and tell people, you know, what will happen. And then once L. Person is dead, they dismembered his body, cut his head off, and threw it at African-Americans down on Beale Street. So these are things that occurred. This is a terror campaign, not just to get rid of the person, but it is intended to send a message, as most of these lynchings did.
Joy, what does it mean to have the work that you all, as part of the Truth and Justice Project, are doing in Ocoee and Orange County, connected to this bigger project, this bigger mission of trying to commemorate the victims of, you know, this terrible period in American history?
Well, it has a lot to do with, I think, that in you can't move forward and really understand the problems we have with race in this country until you look at some of this really difficult history. And it is painful. So I think we see ourselves as the work we do here is important, but it is part of a larger network. And we've learned a lot and been inspired by the work of the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery and the Civil Rights Museum that they've started there and the Memorial to Lynching Victims.
What are your goals for making sure that people don't forget about the Ocoee Massacre?
Well, one of the exciting things we have coming up, and I think our goals are just so that people know about it. It gets forgotten and it gets very confused with other dramatic events, like recently the Groveland Four, who were involved in that incident in around 1950, have been pardoned, and people get the Ocoee Massacre confused with that. They get it confused with Groveland. They get it confused with Rosewood. And other things not so much as known about it. But through the programs we have, we hope that people will know about it and talk about it and talk about how we don't want things like this to ever happen again because of people really dehumanizing other people. Mm-hmm. We have an exciting exhibit, I think, coming up in connection with the Orange County Regional History Center. It'll be there in 1920, and will be the first historic exhibit in Orange County about the Ocoee event. And we're very excited about that. And we think there'll be a lot of programs related to that and chances to discuss it. And as I said, we've already been doing that and really gotten great response.
John.
Yeah. One of the other things I was going to say as we're talking about this is the other thing that's important to keep in mind as we talk about this racial terror is to understand the links between that and where we are today. There's really a straight line. It's a difficult conversation, but there's a straight line between the terrorism that existed then to send the message and where we are in terms of race relations today.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. After the break, we continue our conversation with John Ashworth, Margaret Vandiver, and Joy Wallace Dickinson. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking with Margaret Vandiver and John Ashworth of the Memphis Lynching Sites Project and Joy Wallace Dickinson with the Truth and Justice Project of Orange County about the work underway to remember lynching victims. Ashworth continues our conversation by talking about the legacy of that era.
We haven't dealt with the human aspect of this. I mean, we've looked at it and said this lynching is horrible, but as we sit here and talk about lynchings and we talk about massacres, we have the Rosewood Massacre, we have the Tulsa, Oklahoma, we have the Lane, Arkansas, and it just kind of goes on. Now, those are massacres. In addition to the massacres where there were a lot of people killed, you have the individual lynchings that take place. So you have these two things that are going on to send these messages. But if you look at the history of the country and say the way one group of people sees another people in this process that we have of othering each other. And that's one of the greatest challenges that we have in front of us today is the way that we have othered each other. And we need to understand that all of that is sitting on top of hate. But what's sitting underneath all of that is money. And we really don't talk about, if you talk about slavery and understand that slavery was an economic system. It was an economic system. And if you understand where we are in this country today, one group of people were able to get the wealth that their labor created. Another group of people had no wealth from their labor to pass on. So you have this huge disparity and all that goes with that. Then you lay on top of that this continuous othering that has been historically a part of our process. For 254 years, African Americans were property. They were not people, they were property. And then you come through the Civil War, then you go through this period of saying, well, now you're their equal, and we haven't resolved any of that. And one of the things that James Weldon Johnson, who wrote Lift Every Voice and Sing, actually went to the site where L. Persons was burned to death, and he said, upon looking at that and realizing that he came to realize that the problem of race is the issue of saving black American bodies and white America's soul. And that statement is as true today as it was when he uttered it a little over 100 years ago.
So there's work to do, but is some of what you're doing with the Lynching Site Project and some of what's happening here in Orange County and I'm sure other places as well, is that sort of part of that work?
Yes. In other words, a part of dealing with racial healing, it's very much a part of what we do. We We seek to have conversations that are difficult and uncomfortable, which I think is the only way that we make real progress where racial healing is concerned. You've got to have these difficult conversations.
Dr. Vandiver, what do you say to people who say, you know, leave the past alone, it's too painful and just don't dig it up?
Why are you digging this up? Why are you bringing this up? Why are you putting us through this? I kind of think of the past as the ground we're walking on, and you can ignore it if you want to, and you can pretend that there's not quicksand in front of you, but when you walk through it, you're going to sink and you're not going to make any progress. The history does not go away simply because we choose to ignore it. If it were that simple, I think we would be way ahead of where we are right now. There's a drag, there's a pull of history that continues, and I think by acknowledging it and working through it, we can have some hope of going forward. I just wanted to mention that there's a whole body of social science research being done now that looks at lynching, the historic geographic distribution of lynchings, and correlates that with modern phenomena, and have found significant correlations with the level of hate crimes enforcement, growth rates in imprisonment, imposition of death sentences, executions carried out, homicide rates, housing segregation, Ku Klux Klan mobilization, and even county mortality rates. Now, nobody is saying that historic lynching is a direct causal factor in those events, but it's clear that there is some way in which there's an enduring legacy of lynching that's played out in our modern social problems.
John mentioned the economic aspect, and I think one of the things that's forgotten and is tremendously significant in the Okoye event is that there were people, black families, who owned significant property, and it was taken from them. And that's had tremendous effect on the generations that descended from those people. I mean, their land was lost and resold to white owners.
Is there any chance of reparation for those families?
Well, that's a good question, and I think it's probably one of the things that will be discussed. I think one of the difficulties in the Okoye case is because the population really scattered and left Okoye, it was not easy to really trace the descendants so much, and that's one of the things our project is doing now. But it happened in many places, towns across the South, practice called white capping, in which quite consciously African Americans were driven from their property. And there's some thought that that might have been part of the case in Okoye. There's some evidence that it might have been planned in advance. Or, other evidence suggests it might have just been something that got out of town, out of control that night. But it definitely resulted in a community in which had about 200 black residents, a thriving agricultural community, and for decades after that, not one.
That was true in Elaine, Arkansas. And there, they know that they killed 237 people because that's the bodies they buried, although the estimates for the numbers are more like 800, and thousands of acres of land lost. And in fact, they did a truth-telling there, and I was there as part of that. And one of the things that, and the truth-telling was done by the grandchildren of the people who fled into the swamps that survived the massacre. And one of the things they said, somebody said, well, what do you want now? I said, just give me the land back. And then another person on the panel said, well, we should be able to go to the courthouse and trace the records. You can't because the courthouse burned down. But then when you start looking across the South, there were a lot of courthouses that burned down. So to try and go back and establish that record, you can't. Or even if you find the record, it's a legal document. And it's not an arm's-length transaction, but then how do you prosecute a non-arm's-length transaction because it was at the point of fear?
Is it hard to kind of reconcile this part of history with this image of America as this kind of beacon of freedom and justice?
It's very difficult because the history that all of us were taught, whether this was before integration or after integration, the history that we have all been taught is really an inaccurate history. There's so much that's left out. I talked to a number of people who says, well, yeah, we talked about slavery when I was going to school, but it was only about a paragraph. We talked about Reconstruction, but it wasn't that much. You didn't really get into the nuances. And so it's difficult for America because, America, you don't really know your past. Dr. Vanwood,
let me ask you a question about the way history is taught then. And I mean, this could be something, a question for you as well, Joy. But Dr. Vandiver, I mean, is there a need to go back and rethink the way that history, whether it's, you know, from the 1800s or the 20th century, is taught in high schools or even in universities?
Oh, yes, I think there certainly is. I think we need to draw out all of these themes that we've been mentioning and tie them very explicitly to our current situation, because if we ignore these things, as all three of us have said, they simply are going to keep entangling us and making it difficult to move ahead in any way.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that, Joy?
Yeah, I think it's history really has been traditionally, it's changed a lot during my lifetime, but traditionally told from a very specific point of view that mm-hmm. really reflected the attitudes of white men in the ruling class and what they thought was important. And one of the reasons we have Women's History Month and Black History Month, this is Women's History Month, is because there were so many people whose stories just weren't told at all. You know, women as well as African Americans and other minorities, just their attainments were not perceived as particularly important. Mm-hmm. They were not in positions where they had influence. I mean, I think one of the great lines from the musical Hamilton at the end is, "Who lives, who dies, who tells the story?" And, you know, the people that tell the story really control it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's just from one point of view.
So is the measure of success for a historian, whether you're involved in this project, the Truth and Justice Project, or anything else, is to make sure that some stories that haven't been given some airtime actually get told?
Yeah, I think that's an important part of it, mm-hmm. you know, is to represent the people that didn't get a chance to tell their story.
John Ashworth, is there an end point that you have in mind for the Lynching Sites Project, or is this ongoing?
I don't know that there's an end point that we have. We will get to a point where we will no longer be able to necessarily put a mark up to an individual, and we may wind up because, you know, you've got parking lots have been paved over, you've got big developments there, but I think we will get to a point where we will recognize as many as we can find. We'll do something along those lines. But the more important work that we do will be towards educating people and having this conversation. I mean, there are a lot of people that are coming into this, but we only just began to scratch the surface. So do I see an end point for the work that we are doing? And many, many others like us across the country. No, I don't see an end point to that anytime soon. We're talking about 400 years of this. So this is not something that you will do for 4 or 5 or 10 years and it'll go away. We will need to continuously work at this.
It must be heartening, though. I mean, you talked about the high school students who made their own marker for one of these tragedies, and they're actually kind of taking their initiative to research the history and do something about it.
You know, I have to honestly say, and we've all seen the pictures of, you know, two young children, one black, one white, or whatever, and the two of them, they have no problem dealing with each other. It's when they come into the larger society. And it's, you know, sometimes we make ourselves comfortable by saying, well, the young people in high school don't have this problem. They'll get it right. If they didn't have the other outside influences once they went home to their churches, shopping, et cetera, they'd get it right. But it is very much a part of our DNA. I absolutely applaud what they're doing here in Orange County and across the country, because it is getting this truth out there. It is confronting people with it. And I'm finding that people who I would have considered to be the silent majority before are saying, no, we really have to talk about this. And there are more and more people that are willing to come to the table and have the conversation. I do feel that there is a groundswell of people of goodwill who are beginning to say, let's have this conversation. I was invited to speak at a white church in Scottsboro, Alabama, the home of the Scottsboro Boys. You know, that was 9 young black boys between the age of 12 and 19 that were accused of raping 2 white females. One of the white females said, no, that's not happened. I was lying. The state of Alabama eventually exonerated all of them. But I'm saying that speaks to goodwill among people. It says, you know, this is difficult. This is uncomfortable. And for a lot of people, there is that power structure that still controls things, that they feel threatened and jeopardized, even though they want to have that conversation. But we are making progress. You know, I'm hopeful.
Well, John Ashworth is the Executive Director of the Lynching Sites Project of Memphis. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Also joined by Joy Wallace Dickinson. She's an historian and a task force member of the Truth and Justice Project. Joy, thank you as well.
Thank you.
And Dr. Margaret Vandiver, a retired professor with the University of Memphis, and she is researching for the Lynching Sites Project. Dr. Vandiver, thank you as well.
Thank you so much.
Still to come on Intersection, Nerd Night Orlando turns 6.
The world has changed, the culture has changed, and the things that we thought were nerdy just happen to be really cool things. You know, being into tech is not a fringe thing anymore. The guy who was a tech guy is the richest man in the world, and the guy who's in the comics is now the guy working for Marvel, making sure that they're the most popular franchise in, you know, the film industry.
A conversation with Nerd Night Orlando founder Ricardo Williams. That's when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Nerd Night Orlando is turning 6. The monthly thinking and drinking event is celebrating Pi Day this Thursday. From the Education Desk this week, we're joined by Nerd Night Orlando founder Ricardo Williams for a conversation about what keeps people coming back to the monthly meetup, which aims to take learning beyond the classroom and teach people about esoteric, cool things. Well, Ricardo Williams, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you, Matt, for having me once again.
It's been a while since we've talked to you about Nerd Night. What's changed in the years since?
We've gotten older. We got our 6-year anniversary coming up on March 14th. And I love that our very first event was on March 14th, and that date has a lot of significance. It's the birth date of Albert Einstein. It's obviously Pi Day. And every year, every month, we do a Nerd Night on the second Thursday. And this year, being the 6th anniversary, that Thursday once again falls on March 14th for the first time in 6 years. So it's a very special day, and I want to kind of make that day like an Orlando day. Like, I want it to be like not just this kind of universal holiday for scientists, but, you know, a cool, nerdy day for us here in Orlando.
Do you think Pi Day does Pi a bit of an injustice? Because people are thinking of the kind of pie you can eat.
I think it goes both ways. I mean, I think they help each other. Let's put it that way. We actually had our 2-year anniversary, we had a pie eating contest. And my friend Brendan O'Connor was one of the judges for that. And it was cool. You know, it's if you can take anything about science and make it fun, you're just going to open more doors and let more people in. And I think that's a good thing.
So what about the audience over those last 6 years? What have you seen in the audience?
What I really love about Nerd Night is what an incredibly diverse audience we have in terms of background, but also in profession. And we have folks who, you know, who are NASA scientists who come out to Nerd Night and also have spoken at Nerd Night. But we also have folks who are like architects and people who are plumbers who build chairs. And there's a science to everything. And it's really interesting to have those folks come to Nerd Night and kind of share a space, but then also say, hey, I want to do a talk. So right then and there, you, by having a more diverse audience, you have more ideas on stage and you have more interesting people.
So has the focus of the talks changed a little bit from high-level science to kind of more daily science, or I didn't realize there was some scientific angle to whatever this person's profession is and let's learn about it?
I would say that it's always been very esoteric. I'm not sure if it has become more every day, but, you know, I was just on a call the other day with a new Nerd Night organizer and also a new Nerd Night speaker, and just kind of talking about, like, what my personal vision has always been. It's just when you make the talk more specific, it becomes more your own, and it becomes more a talk that only you could give and not anybody else. And I think that's what makes it special. And by doing that, that could be something that's every day, but it could be something that's high level. You know, one of my all-time favorite talks, I say this all the time, is my good friend Amy Selikoff. She talked about flags, and she talked about why they look a certain way, why Nepal is the only flag that has, you know, two triangles and not be a four-sided polygon. I think that's wonderful, but we also have a NASA scientist who talks about if it's possible to grow cannabis in space. So you have these talks that are like only they could give. It's their medium, you know.
Mm-hmm. And Nerd Night is all over the country, right? It's everywhere.
Yeah, we have Nerd Nights and cities and countries all across the world. We have Nerd Nights all over Alaska, Tokyo, here in this part of the country. Miami has been going strong. Nerd Night St. Pete, we just launched that last week. Nerd Night Jacksonville. We had a one-night event at the Jacksonville Science Center, or excuse me, the Jacksonville Science Festival, and we're going to be making that a recurring event for those folks up there. So yeah, we have Nerd Nights in cities all around the world, and they're all pretty regular. And what's really great is that they're all very different in terms of where they're hosted at. Sometimes they're at a bar, sometimes they're at a science center or a museum or a library. But the gist of it is the same, and the whole point is to remind folks that learning is fun, and you bring a bunch of adults together, and we have a couple of speakers on stage who essentially nerd out about what they're most passionate about. And it's really special to have that in different cities. You know, you want to continue your education, you want to be in a space where you can learn something new and also meet other interesting people like yourself.
How important is the location?
The location is very important. there's been times where we've had like special events in other cities, and sometimes the venue will be too nice, if that makes any sense. You know, it's like it's not really the.
So you need something a little gritty around the
edges.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, if there was a CBGB's in Orlando, if anybody knows what CBGB's is, that was just like a small hole in the wall that could fit 45 people. It had a nice little stage and a great liquor, beer, and wine selection. That would be ideal for me on a personal level. I come from I listen to a lot of punk music when I was growing up. So the idea of Nerd Night is very punk to me. It's very like DIY, and it's just very like, but it may seem really rough around the edges, but it's still very, we're taking it very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Like I don't look at The Clash and say like, oh, they didn't take their music very seriously, even though it was like hardcore punk and just really fun and ridiculous, but they were incredible musicians and they took their work very seriously, and that's how I see Nerd Night events.
So tell me about the location in Orlando. What is it like?
We've used a couple of different places. We've used the Abbey, which is like kind of like the premier, you know, entertainment venue downtown, and they've been really supportive, and we've had a couple events there, and I absolutely love it. We've also used Stardust, which is where we had our very first event on March 14th. 2013, which, wow, 6 years. We've used the Church Street Exchange building in the atrium area. We've used Ferg's Depot. Ferg's Depot's bar restaurant that is no longer downtown, but when they were there, we were there.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been lucky enough to have an event at the library, of all places, the Orlando Public Library downtown, which I am a huge patron of. I go there and pick up a lot of graphic novels and comics. And I love to use the Melrose Center every once in a while. And the library's been very supportive, and they've been a kind of a partner in a lot of different things that we've done. So we were lucky enough to be able to have an event there this past year, which for me was a personal high, because I don't think we utilize our libraries enough. I don't think we use them as like really kind of a public community space. And we just so happened to have an award-winning library system here in Orlando. They just won a national award.
You're talking about the Orange County Public Library System.
That's correct. Yeah, Orange County Public Library System. Every single branch that I've been to is just, it's incredible. And the downtown one is the most convenient for me because I live downtown. But there's so many incredible services that they have there. Classes, the Melrose Center, which is this incredible co-working space, interactive space. There's workspaces there. There's different computers that you can use. And there's just so much to utilize, and this is a public utility. I mean, mm-hmm. We should really take advantage of it.
I love the building too. The architecture,
yeah.
the concrete with the you can still see the pattern of the wood framing in it. It's amazing,
and it's cool to see those old photos too of like downtown from like 50, 60 years ago, and to see how it's changed. And one of the things that have remained the same is the public library.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm a big fan, and so having a Nerd Night there was a big deal for me on a personal level, but I would love to have more events there in the future.
Are you still looking for a permanent location for Nerd Night? Like, would you like to have a hole-in-the-wall bar where this is the home for Nerd Night month in, month out, and then from time to time you go to a bigger venue or somewhere a little bit special?
Yeah, I would like that. And to be honest, Stardust has kind of been that space in a lot of ways. Like, it's, you know, obviously, in terms of size, the Abbey is far larger and has a larger occupancy than Stardust. But no matter the venue that we've been in, the room seems to fit. You know, it needs to be the right venue for the right month, too, for the right set of speakers, for the right topics. And Stardust has really kind of been that kind of like cool little hole-in-the-wall punk venue. But they have an incredible, like I said, incredible liquor selection. You know, it's a cool community spot, and everybody loves Stardust, you know, and it's been like a nice little Orlando staple for the last, you know, 15 years or so. So it's kind of been that space. But I also like to move the event around because I want to kind of almost kind of bring attention to a new space. You know, there's been times where, like, when we used Ferg's Depot, they had just opened. And a friend of mine was working there, and I was like, well, let's get more people in the door. This is a nice spot, you know. And I want to make sure that, you know, Nerd Night doesn't exist just to serve Nerd Night. I want it to really be kind of a staple of the community. And we've had, you know, almost 100 events in the last 6 years. You know, that's a lot of guest speakers. That's a lot of people coming through. It's a huge audience. And I want to be able to support those people that have supported us. So let's direct them to a new cool place. Let's support other businesses. And maybe there's somebody in the audience who has a business. And let's find a way where we can support you in some capacity and just kind of get some folks through the door.
It sounds a little bit too like Nerd Night is in some ways a bit like TEDx or, you know, TED Talk. And it has all these spin-offs. Is there a youth component? Like, is there a junior Nerd Night that you take to schools and you can kind of spark the interest? Because you're focused on, and you said before, you're focused on adults talking about nerdy things instead of nerding out. And maybe sometimes even, you know, throwing back to something they were passionate about when they were a kid. But what about fostering the next generation of nerds?
First thing I can tell you is that I think we talked about the TED comparisons in the past. And I've always tried to kind of be very supportive of other programs, but also show the difference between Nerd Night and other things.
Sure. Nerd Night's better, right?
Well, I mean, you said it, not me. But I think one of the things that I've said the most is that a lot of other programs are relatively expensive to attend, and they know about them as a brand, not necessarily as something as a personal connection. And I've always wanted Nerd Night to be that, like, really kind of every man's event, regardless of who
grassroots.
Yeah, I want it to feel very grassroots, and regardless of your socioeconomic status, like whether you can fly to Argentina to go to the National TED Conference, you know, like, or watch the video on your phone, you know, like, I want people in this area to feel like they're a part of it. Nerd Night, I may be the guy carrying the flag, but it doesn't belong to me. It belongs to all of us, you know.
Mm-hmm. Does Nerd Night have a flag?
We got a logo. I have a cheap banner that I made. I don't know if it's a flag, but you know, Nerd Night is for the working class people. You know, it's for everybody. You know, and but in terms of the next generation, it's very much an adult event. Mm-hmm. I will say that. Just
sure, it's an evening of thinking and drinking.
Yeah, people are have their libations, so it's an adult event. But I will say there are certain venues where you don't necessarily have to be old enough to be there. Mm-hmm. So we've been at the comic book shop, you know, years past. And, you know, obviously you don't have to be 21 to come in the door for that. So I've had folks who have brought their teenagers and, you know, sometimes as young as 11 and 12. And if that's the case, we just make sure that the language is for, you know, PG rated.
Sure.
But the only thing that really separates it is that I don't want it to be. By making that event for a child, I don't want to change what it is currently. Mm. I don't want to have to, like, water it down. And that doesn't mean necessarily taking out the alcohol, the language, or the adult language that we may use in the context of the talks. But it just means that I just don't want to change what it is. I'd rather do something separate that was different. And we've chatted about that as a global network, just like kind of what we would do in that sense. But they've never really kind of come to fruition. Mm-hmm. Now, on a personal note, I'm happy to do other things, you know, like when we do Nerd Nights at science festivals and stuff like that, and that has more of a general audience. Mm-hmm. We just did one, like I said, at the Jacksonville Science Festival, and that was really awesome. And but yeah, I'm happy to do other things.
Well, and I think we talked about this last time we had you on Intersection, Ricardo, but you know, is there a sense for folks who attend Nerd Night, it's kind of like finding your tribe, and maybe back when they were in school, it wasn't cool to be into whatever they were into, whether it's Dungeons and Dragons, or whether it was math, or whether it was, you know, collecting stamps or something. Has that attitude changed, do you think, towards nerddom, if I can use that phrase?
Yeah, the culture has definitely changed. I mean, you would have seen, if I would have used the word nerd, you know, 25, 30 years ago, you would have thought it in the context of somebody who's essentially a social outcast, someone who is socially inept, you know, but at the same time, really intelligent. And the culture has changed really because the world has changed. The nerds of the 80s are the most wealthiest people in the world, or they're the guys that are, you know, driving sports cars and that kind of stuff. So it's if you look at those pictures of Jeff Bezos when he first started Amazon, you know, and he has like the pullover sweater and, you know, he just looks kind of geeky in his responses. And now you look at him now and he's like the guy that's been the bodybuilder or something, you know, that's also the richest man in the world. So the world has changed, the culture has changed, and the things that we thought were nerdy just happen to be really cool things. You know, being into tech is not a fringe thing anymore. You know, being into comic books are not a fringe thing anymore. Like, if the guy who was a tech guy is the richest man in the world and the guy who's into comics is now the guy working for Marvel, making sure that they're the most popular franchise in, you know, the film industry, changed.
Are you happy with that, or is there a part of you that thinks, man, I wish nerds could just have their own thing without it being popular anymore?
The punk side of me would say I'm not happy with it. But I can tell you, genuinely, honestly, I'm happy to know that the things that I like are shared with more people. I don't want to be one of those folks who say, like, well, if everybody likes it, then you're a sellout or it's different. And I totally reject that idea. But also, too, I was born in the 80s. And the 80s is the decade for science fiction. It is the decade. I mean, people were writing about it before it happened. But then when you get to the 80s, it was just like this the world was so different. You have Watchmen, you have Ghostbusters, you have Back to the Future, and particularly Ghostbusters and Back to the Future. For me, those films are scientists being funny. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially what Nerd Night is to me. It's like folks who are into science, or to one of the sciences, one of the main sciences, and then making it fun and making it for everybody. And science has historically been very kind of a bit in a box. Mm-hmm. The communities that are scientist communities in the past have been, you know, sometimes very sexist and misogynistic and very kind of closed off to the general public. And the idea that it could be for everybody is, I think, is a good thing and a very mm-hmm. special thing, you know.
What can we expect from this upcoming Nerd Night?
So this Nerd Night is going to be really awesome. Aside from it being just a really awesome day and the significance of Pi Day, we have a returning speaker, your colleague, Mr. Brendan Byrne, who's going to come back for his third Nerd Night talk. And I like to do that every once in a while, is if there's a kind of like a fan favorite amongst the audience, bring him back. And he talked about space feces, if that's the correct terminology I can use on the air. I think
space poop is the scientific
okay.
term.
All right, space poop, scientific term. All right, I can say that. He's talked about that in the past, and he's coming back to do a new talk on it. And obviously, I'm a big fan of all you guys all here at WMFE. So it's a personal request from me. Just if it's our birthday, you know, I wanted something. But also, we have a new Nerd Night speaker who's actually come out from Nerd Night LA, Dr. Krista Noble, and she's going to be talking about consciousness. And it's going to be very relevant to what I'm going to be talking about in the intro. And we're going to bring back the dry T-shirt contest. We're going to give away some free stuff.
What is the dry T-shirt contest?
The dry T-shirt contest, as you can imagine, is the nerdy version of a wet T-shirt contest. So there is absolutely no sexism, absolutely no misogyny whatsoever. It is basically the nerdiest shirt wins the contest, mm-hmm. and the audience votes on it. And I will be having a prize for them, amongst some other giveaways we're going to do.
Well, Ricardo Williams, he's in charge of Nerd Night Orlando, and he has his 6th anniversary coming up. Ricardo, thank you so much. Always a pleasure having you on the show. Appreciate
thank you for having me, man.
And you can find a link with more information about Nerd Night Orlando over on our website, wmfe.org/intersection. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners and from Advent Health. Education reporting on 90.7 News is supported by Helios Education Foundation. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Ashley Garrett. Subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. You can follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. And thanks for listening.